The Secret Temple is the new book out from Peter Lavenda. Love how he researches the material here, and I think you will too if you pick up a copy of this book. Very readable. It brings us into a discussion of both the Masons and Masonry as a formative force in the creation of the United States as we know it, including our sacred geometry, and more on that coming up. But, you know, we know that the Priory of Sion, we know that that is a fictional organization. Dan Brown purports it to be real in the Da Vinci Code, but you know, any critical historian would say that it's a well-known hoax created in the 1950s by a Nazi-leaning Frenchman who is making some unusual claims in creative ways as kind of a power grab. So we can dispense with the authenticity of the Priory of Sion, but not with the Knights Templar, and not with the Masons, and not with the Illuminati. We'll get back to that next. Just who were the Illuminati? What can we know about them for sure? And in respect to the new movie Angels and Demons coming up, just how powerful are they still to this day? Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. We're a ways away yet from you joining the conversation, but I promise you, you'll have the chance to. And we've got a lot of ground to cover between now and then that I really want to get to out of The Secret Temple from Peter Lavenda. So let's talk about the Illuminati. They are the antagonists of the of Angels and Demons, depending on, I guess, your point of view on that. But the Illuminati being a supposed multinational secret society, even more powerful and even more secretive than Masonry. What do you think?
Well, no.
I knew the answer, but I was just giving you an easy setup there to spike it over the net. All right, so say no and why.
Well, of course, the Illuminati did exist. It was a real organization. There's no doubt at all about that. It was founded in 1776, oddly enough, within only a few weeks before we would write our own Declaration of Independence and basically secede from Great Britain. So these ideas were around at the time. And the Illuminati was probably the perfect group to give, you know, fuel to the fire of conspiracy theorists, because what the creator of the Illuminati wanted to do, a man called Adam Weishaupt, he was a professor of theology in Bavaria at the University of Ingolstadt. What he wanted to do was to use Freemasonry, use the Masonic lodges as his own base, as a network to penetrate into various political arenas around Europe at the time. So he wanted to use the Freemasons to penetrate them, to use them, and to eventually take control of Freemasonry for his own ends.
We might say piggyback.
Yes, you could say that. Yeah, and it was a diabolical plot, you could say. He was much more extreme than the Masons were when it came to ideas like personal liberty, freedom, etc. I think that Weishaupt came much closer to an atheistic kind of point of view, even though he was a Jesuit and even though he was a professor, a doctor of theology. He was very, very radical in his ideas. And he did want to overthrow various European governments. I mean, that was what he was about. So it scared everyone. And I believe that although they were suppressed really early on, Weishaupt had to go and escape. He was deported, essentially, went into exile, and died, you know, still writing tracts about, you know, the new man that he wanted to create, the new human being, sort of the next step of evolution and all of this. I believe there was a definite Illuminati influence on the French Revolution. People asked George Washington if he believed the Illuminati had anything to do with the events in the new colonies, in the new United States, as it was fighting England. And Washington said Illuminatist ideas probably were in the United States, but that the Freemasons were not part of that. He did not subscribe to them. George Washington, as we know, was a Freemason. He believed in Masonic ideas, but he rejected the Illuminati completely. I think we could safely say they were suppressed successfully in the 19th century, that they never really came back again after the early 1800s. But the rumors about them, the legends, of course, were they just grew and grew. So at one point, there was a bit of an Illuminati hysteria in the United States. They thought the Illuminati people were everywhere. And then, of course, that morphed into the Masonic hysteria in the early 1800s also. So you had a lot of paranoia about these secret societies, and justifiably so, if you think about it.
Right. Well, and yeah, here you have a nascent country. Or a country taking its first, you know, baby steps into toddlerhood, and everything looked like a threat. It almost like a new mother looking around a living room and seeing every corner of every coffee table as a potential threat. It was a sensitive time. Nobody knew how many footsteps we were going to be able to put in front of each other before the whole experiment could fall apart. So, you know, maybe hyper sensitive to anybody coming in and creating a government within this government and taking it over. I think that's a great transition into then how many of the founding fathers, as you research it, as you can prove it, were Masons? How many of them could we say were fellow travelers with the Masonic ideals? And how much of a role does that play in the formation of the United States?
I think that Masonic ideals were what really contributed to the revolution. I think that if we think of Freemasonry as a laboratory for Enlightenment ideas, the kind of ideas promoted by Voltaire and Rousseau and John Locke and all the other philosophers of freedom, of liberty, and all of this of human responsibility, all of that was going around. And I think the Masonic lodges provided a great place for these people to get together and to discuss these things secretly, because the lodges were, after all, secret. I mean, it was a secret society with secret initiations, and I think that they provided the venue for these discussions. When we talk about the founding fathers, people may be surprised to know that of the 39 signers of the U.S. Constitution, for instance, 13 were Freemasons. That's one-third of the people who signed the Constitution. But even more, of all the commissioned generals of the Continental Army fighting the British, virtually half of all the generals were Freemasons.
We should point out that the generals on the British side were also Freemasons.
Yes, they were.
And that's part of the interesting part about this, is that Freemasonry didn't require that you choose a side. In fact, Freemasonry almost called upon the participants to be loyal to whatever government or under whosoever rule they found themselves.
Well, that's true. In any Masonic lodge, you will find that their political discussions are not allowed and religious discussions are not allowed. You're expected to be loyal to the government of whatever country you happen to be in. But this gave a problem for our founding fathers, because as Freemasons, how could they revolt against England? How could they revolt against George III? Speaking Masonically, they would have to have been loyal to George III. But something happened, you know, something happened between one side of the Atlantic and the other, where suddenly the Masons in our country decided, well, there's a limit, and this is the limit. And what we're going to do is we're going to create, you know, a new republic. We're going to create a new country based on these Enlightenment, Masonic, if you will, principles, and no one's going to stop us. So you had this weird situation where you had Masons on both sides of that conflict, and fraternally in some cases. But when the Freemasons themselves today, for instance, will tell you no such thing as a Masonic conspiracy, it wasn't Freemasons who created the United States, et cetera, they will almost in the same breath talk about how Masonic lodges were used as safe houses throughout the colonies, where Masons could meet and they could transfer information, transfer funds and everything else. It's a very strange situation we find ourselves in when we talk about the revolution.
I think that's true in my experience, too, in conversations with Masons who, out of one side of their mouth, will talk about how there is no Masonic conspiracy. But then they also take a lot of pride in what even they perceive as being ownership of the United States in a way that both intellectually and also in the symbolism of the United States, that they see Masonry as it's represented in the way in which the United States was claiming itself with its symbols. I'll hold on that for just a second, just so we can wrap up the discussion about the founding fathers, because I love how you phrase it in the book that The Secret Temple, that it's not just the founding fathers that end up signing the Declaration of Independence, but we could really look at it, and there's a long line of Europeans, in a way, that are signing the Declaration of Independence at the same time.
Right. I mean, from my point of view, because I see what was taking place as an Enlightenment movement, the European Enlightenment, which involved a lot of the French philosophers and French thinkers. I mean, Voltaire was initiated into the Lodge of Nine Sisters in Paris, which was a hotbed of revolutionary thought and ideas. And he was brought to that initiation by Benjamin Franklin. Benjamin Franklin, who was a Mason, who actually, on his printing press, the very first Masonic book in the United States, or in the American colonies at that time, was published, the Constitutions of Freemasonry. So Benjamin Franklin was very much involved in Freemasonry on both sides of the Atlantic, very much involved in France.
Yeah.
He was in communication with these Enlightenment philosophers. And from my point of view, the American Revolution was signed not just by our own Masonic founding fathers, but also by all of these thinkers like John Locke and like Voltaire and Rousseau and the others who contributed the ideas that led to what would become this great experiment in this country.
Let's talk about the sacred geometry of Washington quickly then, too. Both of the man and of later on the city that's named in his honor, one of the most famous paintings of Washington shows him wearing his Masonic apron. What does that painting, what should we see in that painting? What is that painting making a claim for?
Well, he's laying the cornerstone of the U.S. Capitol building. There has been a lot of discussion recently as to the real spiritual significance of the U.S. Capitol, and I think it's something that Americans should be aware of and should be sensitive to when they visit the nation's capital and they visit the Capitol building. By laying that cornerstone, the cornerstone, the foundation stone that way, allowing himself to be painted wearing the Masonic regalia, and with a lot of other Masons in attendance, they were making a statement about how the United States was founded, what it was founded on, the types of principles it was founded upon. Freemasonry was intended to be the unity of all men, and I say that very deliberately because women were not allowed to be Freemasons. That's another part of the discussion for a little later on, maybe. But
or the unity of all white men, we should say.
Of all white men, we should also stipulate, all white men. But it was at least a step in the right direction, and it was intended to show that there was there were no superiors or inferiors. I mean, if you joined a Masonic lodge and if you were a prince, it was just as likely that you would be initiated by a commoner as it would be by another nobleman. I mean, within the lodge, there were no social ranks. Everyone was equal according to your degree, first, second, or third. So you had no distinctions of race, of class, or anything within the temple itself. There were, of course, problems. They did not allow women to be initiated. They did not allow black people to be initiated because of a rule that said you cannot be the child of a slave. There was all sorts of other things. You could not be handicapped and become a Freemason. So there's a lot of things they had to work on, from my point of view,
right,
in order to achieve this, you know, human liberty and equality concept. But it was there. They were striving for it. They were trying to get there. And the first thing they had to do was get rid of a monarchy, get rid of a bloodline of rulers, and say that we're going to elect our own rulership and be free. So the U.S. Capitol is a manifestation of that. An author called William Henry has written about this and done lectures on it,
right,
on the mystical significance of the U.S. Capitol building, so I won't step on his toes on that. And one of my colleagues, James Wasserman, wrote a book called The Secrets of Masonic Washington, where he talks about the architecture and the various buildings and statues. You can't go anywhere in Washington, D.C. without bumping into a statue of a Freemason somewhere.
Right.
And that's because so many of our founding fathers were. Paul Revere was a Freemason.
Not to mention just statues of Freemasons in Washington that were not founding fathers.
That were not founding fathers, right, just Freemasons.
Right, Albert Pike.
Albert Pike being probably the most famous example.
Yeah.
So, I mean, our nation's capital is a monument to Freemasonry in many respects. And that's not a bad thing. a lot of people look at Freemasonry as a problem, as a society bent on world domination or something. There's no Pope in Freemasonry. There's no one big organizational head that determines what Freemasons do. Lodges are pretty much independent. I don't see Freemasonry as a threat. There are other organizations that I distrust, but Freemasonry in general is not one of them. There have been Masonic conspiracies. The Freemasons are loath to discuss them, but the famous case in Italy of Propaganda Due, the Masonic scandal that rocked Italy, that had so many tentacles around the world, that was one. But that was a criminal enterprise for the most part. That was organized crime and right-wing politics and a lot of other stuff mixed in together. But as far as Freemasonry itself is concerned, the ideals that they brought to the founding of this country, I think, were essentially pure. They really did want to create a free and democratic republic.
And I think that's interesting. And I like how you go into in your book kind of their problem they had, Masons had, in getting over racial issues, anti-Semitism, and really kind of, if not misogyny, at least discrimination on the basis of women not being worthy. And still, there's a problem with that, in my opinion, but I'm not a Mason. But I think it's interesting when you talk about that there was no monarchy. And part of the claim of that whole Knight Templar, keeper of the Holy Grail, as Mary Magdalene, as the Holy Grail, you know, wife of Christ thing, is to maintain the divine right of kings.
Right.
And so, again, I go back to, I just don't see that that's a Knight Templar position. If the Masons really are inheritors of the Knights Templar worldview, the first thing they get rid of is the divine right of kings.
That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I just don't see that as being something which the Knights Templar would have actually maintained. But again, I don't want to sound like I'm fixated on that. I just happen to think the Knights Templar are too cool for the way that they're often described.
There you go. I tend to agree with you on that one.
Okay. So, but getting back to the Masons then, and this, there's an upcoming novel by Dan Brown. We don't know a lot about it. It's The Solomon Key, is one of the titles it's known by, and it's about Freemasonry and the CIA and the Freemasonry and some of the conspiracies in the United States. I do think it's interesting to point out that that Freemasonry was really tested during the Civil War, as again, general versus general. They could both have been Masons. They might have both been from the same Masonic lodge and then found themselves on the opposite sides of the war.
Right. That's correct. I mean, Freemasonry in our country has had a tremendous influence on events, on historical events around us. We just don't always recognize them as such. The Civil War was one example. But just prior to the Civil War, there was the anti-Masonic hysteria, where there was an abduction, a kidnapping of a man who was threatening to reveal Masonic secrets, and he disappeared and was never found again. He was believed to have been murdered. This started a wave of anti-Masonic feelings. People thought that there were Masons everywhere, that they were going to take over the country, they were murdering people and all this other stuff. I think part of the problem stems from the fact that Masons are secret, and we don't tend to believe that anybody who's secret is doing anything, any good.
Yeah, that's the way I feel about my teenagers. I know when they're trying to keep a secret, I know it's not going to be a good one. All right, so let's put on this this conversation on hold for just a second for Peter Lavenda. Then we'll come back, because I want to ask what he knows about a famous story about the Civil War and Freemasonry. I want to throw at Peter Lavenda a little bit more about the possibility that Knights Templar ships might have arrived in the U.S. I didn't see that in the book, but I'm just curious whether in his research he saw anything on that. It goes back to our discussion a couple of weeks ago about the Kensington Runestone, which is here in Minnesota. And then let's move forward, too, into what the real meaning of the secret temple is, according to Peter Lavenda. And then also a little history of the Mormon Church as he sees it. Coming up on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Well, I was just trying to actually do a calculation in my head, the number of open line calls I might have taken over the years. It's got to be, it's well into the upper hundreds, if not thousands. I mean, I don't know, maybe on a busy night, if I was hosting on a Friday for George or Art, I might have done, what do you think, maybe 50 open line calls? I've probably done that enough times to say legitimately into the thousands then for open line calls. And yet I think my favorite my current favorite happened earlier tonight. If you've got Streamlink, go back to that first hour. Listen about three quarters of the way through the first hour. I'm still smiling about the guy calling about whether there's a satanic word that I might be familiar with called Dauma. Just go back and listen if you get a chance. If not, try and catch it on a replay sometime. Well worth it. I'll be smiling about that all week long. And here I was wondering whether I should have gone to open lines in the first hour. So glad I did. And so glad we've got Peter Lavenda for another half hour here before we get to your calls for the Secret Temple coming up. Let's address the history of the Latter-day Saints. We'll address some of the other aspects of secret societies in the United States as it pertains to popular notions about what Masons were up to, true or false, next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Peter Lavenda, the author of The Secret Temple. So where were we? The history of the United States, the Masonic mysteries, especially as they pertain to the founding of America. What about the sacred geometry of Washington? We were talking about a little bit. A caller brought up something I hadn't heard, that the ley line between Washington, D.C. all the way up to Boston doesn't deviate 1 degree. Have you ever heard about that? Is that ever anything you come across?
No, this is news to me. I haven't looked at that.
I hadn't heard that either. I'll put that away. Now, how about this, though? We had a guest on a couple Sundays ago. He's actually a guy I know here in town. He's a geologist by trade. He is a forensic geologist, actually. Does really interesting work working in court cases, lawsuits, testing stone, determining the age of stone. And he was brought in to work on the Kensington Runestone. Do you know what that is?
Yes, I do. Yeah.
Okay. So the Kensington Runestone story is that just before the turn of the last century here in Minnesota, a farmer finds this stone with ancient runes on it, and what would seemingly be a couple of references to a group having been either lost or cut off up at the headwaters of the Mississippi, and some other rivers here in the upper Midwest. And he finds this stone and these runes, which then later on he can trace specifically to an island, Gotland, which is off of Norway, right? Or Denmark. I can't remember all of a sudden. Anyway, but on this island there's a particular Cistercian abbey, which, of course, the Cistercians have a connection to the Knights Templar. And so the author argues that the Knights Templar, who were well-known explorers, would have left this stone here in Minnesota. And in the years is also right there in the 14th century. Where are you with something like that? And what about other references to the Knights Templar having made it to the New World before Columbus?
Well, in Sinister Forces, in the first volume of that, I talk about the Kensington Stone a little bit and some of the other artifacts that have come to light. The Kensington Stone was believed to have been a forgery for so long, and then eventually mm-hmm. it was proved that it was genuine runic
yep.
letters, and you know, there's no doubt about it now.
Right.
So that's only one of many. There's a lot of different of stones, petroglyphs in the United States that are evidence that the North America was visited by Europeans and by people from the Mediterranean hundreds of years before Columbus. I think it's a definite possibility, based on that kind of evidence, the work that was done by Barry Fell, for instance, years ago, the late Barry Fell, a professor at Harvard, who was fascinated with these stones and what they signified, that we had been visited here many times in the past. I think the Templars are a good candidate also. I've read some of the literature. Some of it's very speculative. But some of it, there's room there to believe that perhaps the Templars, in trying to find a place to escape to, especially from Portugal and Spain, which were the last countries to really suppress the Templars, they took a long time before they got around to doing that. The Templars were safe there for a while, and these are maritime countries. And then, they set sail. There was even a rumor that Columbus, that his ships bore the Templar crosses, the red crosses on the white background.
I've heard that. Is that just a historical rumor?
Well, it's a fact that his ships, the sails bore those symbols. Whether or not that indicated a Templar connection or not, of course, that's still kind of speculative. We really don't know.
But it's interesting you should bring that up, the red cross on the white. And that's clear enough of a symbol, or simple enough of a symbol, that we wouldn't necessarily mean it has to be Templar, but right. it sure looked like it, didn't it?
And
the fact that would explain, in a way, how Columbus would have gotten so much of this information about the New World. But all right, well, putting that aside for the moment, then let's then take a little bit of time here to talk about something else, which I thought was very intriguing in your book, that there are some institutions which we don't think of as secret societies. But you make the claim that, for example, the Church of the Latter-day Saints, the Mormon Church, that has a strong Masonic connection, and that the symbols and the traditions of a lot of Freemasonry, or at least the practices of Freemasonry, are still alive in the church today. Can you make that connection?
Sure. I mean, it all goes back to Joseph Smith himself, the founder of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, what we call the Mormons. If we understand that America, in the first couple of hundred years of its existence, was steeped in esoteric arts, there was the governor of Connecticut, Winthrop, who was very involved in alchemy, in their hermetic sciences and all of that. And this is long before even the Salem witchcraft trials, became famous. There was a lot of this involvement by the early founding fathers before the revolution in things of this nature. There was a widespread literature on this that was available to a lot of people. And Joseph Smith, in the very early 1800s, was involved as a farm boy, was involved in rituals of what we call ceremonial magic. He was drawing talismans, drawing magic circles. He had implements that he took with him. He would go out to the woods near his home and essentially conjure angels or spirits to visible appearance, in an effort to find buried treasure. And this was something that was going around. This was a kind of practice that a lot of people did. Joseph Smith had what he called a seer stone. This was like a crystal ball that he would gaze into to discover secrets and to talk with the spirits. Joseph Smith was heavily involved in the occult as a young man, as a young boy and as a young man. And then later, it was his practice of these rituals that led to the creation of the Book of Mormon. He claimed that the angel Moroni had appeared to him, shown him the tablets and the scrolls on which the Book of Mormon was written in hieroglyphics, and then he would write down the Book of Mormon, and then the tablets would go back into the ground or back to the angels, and the Book of Mormon was written based upon these rituals that he performed in the woods of upstate New York.
Now, let me just jump in and ask, what's your source material for that?
Oh, probably the best source material for this is a book by D. Michael Quinn about the magic and Mormonism. It's a huge volume, heavily referenced, footnoted, with photographs of some of the talismans that Joseph Smith owned that were on his person when he died. He was killed by an angry mob. Some of the things that he was carrying are represented there. Some of the books and materials that he used are there. This is not a secret. The Mormons had liked to keep it a secret for a long time, but it eventually came out. And Michael Quinn himself, I think, was chased around the country a little bit. The Mormons were very upset with the fact that he published this very comprehensive source book on this material. There's no doubt about it. Part of the famous Mormon murder case of about 20 years ago or so was based upon the fact that a forger had come up with what he said was a letter that implied that Joseph Smith was conjuring demons. And the Mormons paid a great deal of money to get this letter back and put it in the archives. Later, it was turned out to, it was revealed to be a forgery. But the Mormons were aware of this. They were aware. They are still aware of this information. It's there. And then later on, he became involved in Freemasonry, and this was very unusual also.
Yeah, and I think this must be public knowledge because you have this. This would have been, it seemed like at the time, even something which would have been known in his lifetime that he had become a Mason, and that several other people within the Latter-day Saints movement joined at the same time he did.
This is also quite public knowledge. In fact, it was the Mormons at one point who had the largest Masonic lodges in the state of Illinois. I mean, Joseph Smith, after he became initiated, began initiating like crazy. So there were a lot of Mormons brought into Freemasonry at that time.
Then the question is begged, though, so what? Okay, so he becomes a Freemason like a lot of other people of faith do and create this sort of universalist bond of brotherhood.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what is that? Where does that lead in terms of where you think the Mormon Church goes?
Well, there's a couple of points I should make. The first one is Joseph Smith was the prophet of Mormonism. He created that religion. Now, can you imagine Muhammad becoming a Freemason, or Jesus becoming a Freemason, or Moses becoming a Freemason? You know, so that there is something that you have to sit back and stop and say, well, you had a direct connection already to the divine. You were already channeling divine forces, at least as far as you're concerned, you were. You're writing scriptures. You're creating this entire religious movement. What do you need Freemasonry for, then? What is the point?
Well, and then I'm reminded of the conversation we had about Adam Weishaupt, mm-hmm. that maybe he saw taking over Freemasonry as the fast track to establishing Mormon churches all over the United States, that if he could infiltrate it in that way, change people's hearts and minds to the prophetic vision he was having, it would be the fastest way to create a national, you know, church organization.
Well, very good. Very good idea. It could have been strictly a political maneuver. But what happened eventually was that Joseph Smith incorporated so much Masonic ritual into secret degrees within the Mormon Church, the so-called temple endowment ceremonies and some of the other secret rites that only Mormons who have passed certain qualifications may actually participate in or observe in the temple, in the Mormon temple in Salt Lake City and in some of the other Mormon temples around. I mean, these are based on Masonic temples. These have Masonic symbolism there. The so-called magic underwear that people make fun of that the Mormons wear is a copy of the Masonic apron. I mean, what Smith did was he not only became involved in Freemasonry, he took Masonic ideas and put them into Mormonism and made the higher levels of the Mormon Church more resemble Masonic lodges than anything else. It's incredible. I mean, the amount of Masonic symbolism that he took over, ritual and ideas and concepts, into Mormonism really makes you ask a lot of questions. I mean, what was the purpose of that? You know, it's no longer an attempt to penetrate Freemasonry and to use Freemasonry. It's become part of Mormon religious life.
Okay. And you make an interesting statement in the book that somebody who is a Freemason would walk, if they could walk into the Holy of Holies in the Church of the Latter-day Saints, they would see a lot of similarities and a lot of familiar sort of environments and symbols. And the same thing, too, with somebody who is raised Mormon, for them to go into a Masonic lodge, it would look very familiar and it would feel familiar. Basically.
Oh, absolutely. I think that they would all feel quite familiar and be very comfortable with the surroundings. I think that what happened was that Joseph Smith did see something very valuable in Freemasonry. He embraced it wholeheartedly. And remember, it was at a time of anti-Masonic hysteria in the United States. You know, the Northeast was undergoing a tremendous pressure. The Masonic lodges were being shut down everywhere. People were afraid to show up for the rituals. But suddenly out in the Midwest, in Ohio and Illinois and further west, we see Joseph Smith really promoting Freemasonry in a big way, getting as many of his people as possible to join and become involved with Freemasonry. He saw something there, and I think it goes back to his early beginnings, conjuring spirits in upstate New York and using medieval sorcerer's workbooks to do this. I think there's a connection there. I think that's part of it.
Well, I want to allow you to explore something which I'd never heard of before, and it was intriguing. I've always been curious about the word Mormon. I did years ago, challenged, I think, actually by a caller on Coast to Coast. I did a word study on the word Mormon, and I found it very unsatisfactory. You speculate about a connection for the word Mormon and how Joseph Smith might have come up with it if it hadn't, in fact, been handed to him by a prophet, by an angel in a prophetic dream. Talk to me about what you think the connection might be between the word Mormon and the Masonic controversies of the early part of the 19th century.
Wow. Okay. Well, it's probably more what you're talking about is the angel Moroni, I think, and the word Mormon. Both of these things are very, very mysterious ideas, and we don't, you know, there's been speculation about it. But we have to remember that there was a murder that took place in the early days before Joseph Smith became the Joseph Smith we all know.
And not far from where he lived.
There was the famous Morgan affair. What happened was a man called William Morgan, who was a Freemason, wanted to publish the rituals of Freemasonry for whatever reason. No one really knows if it was just a pecuniary thing, he wanted to make some money or what. But his brothers in the craft said, no, you're not. And there was a big discussion over this, and what happened was Morgan disappeared. It's believed he was murdered by Freemasons in order to protect the secrets. Remember, in those days, the oaths were taken very seriously, and you took an oath to have your eyes plucked out and your disemboweled and all the rest of it if you broke the law and revealed the secrets. So he disappeared. He was gone. And there was speculation as to what happened to him. Well, there was a newspaper article written about this whole thing, and it's possible that the name Morgan came from two different words.
The word Mormon came from two different words.
Right.
Okay. Not Morgan. Right. Morgan. No. That Morgan, the name of the victim, the purported victim, and then what else?
And the name of a body that was discovered that was believed to have been Morgan, but was actually one of a guy called Timothy Monroe, which was spelled M-O-N-R-O in the newspapers of the time. But because of the way they set the type, the syllables were broken. The name Morgan had been broken into two syllables, more and gan. And directly below the more syllable in the newspaper was the name of Monroe, M-O-N-R-O. So we have this placement of more Monroe, or Mormon. And it's believed that that's where the name Mormon came from, was this very strange newspaper article about the purported death of William Morgan, the discovery of the body of Timothy Monroe, who was believed to have been William Morgan. It's all very complicated, but that the word Mormon came from the conflation of those two names of Morgan and Monroe. But what's interesting is that William Morgan's widow then marries Joseph Smith,
which is still one of the most amazing things, that the very and becomes one of his plural wives.
Yes. Just think about that for a second. I mean, what other stronger case can you make for Joseph Smith's interest in Freemasonry beyond his own initiations? You know, is the fact that he goes and he marries the widow of the man who was believed to have caused the anti-Masonic hysteria by his disappearance. It's
very
fascinating stuff.
It is. Well, the phones have been ringing like crazy. Everybody wants to talk to Peter Lavenda, the author of The Secret Temple. There are two things left that we haven't gotten to yet. One of which is the meaning of the Secret Temple, and I won't forget to get to that. And then I also want to go over a quick little piece from the Civil War, and I want to get Peter Lavenda on whether or not there's any truth to that Masonic story. That's what this book is all about, and I think it's very well researched. Agree with them or not, it's footnoted at the end of every paragraph, and there's something there to follow up. Masons, Mysteries, and the Founding of America, Peter Lavenda. You'll join the conversation coming up next. And then I remind you, too, that if you want to go back and streamlink and listen to that interview we had about the Kensington runestone, I'm even more compelled by the compelling new evidence of the Kensington Runestone. That was a couple of weeks ago on a Sunday on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.